课堂听 class.com。
全国翻译专业资格水平考试指定教材，英语口译综合能力二级，第四核。
Practice tests. Test 1. Comprehensive examination for Interpreter 2. Part 1. Listen to the short passages and then decide whether the corresponding statements below are true or false.There are 10 questions in this part of the test. 2 points for each question.
1. On a global scale, violence kills 1.6 million people a year. It leaves millions more with injuries, disabilities, and mental disorders. Its causes are complex and its consequences are devastating.
2. In order to provide the latest information about violence,WHO launched the World Report on Violence and Health in 2002. This is the first report to provide a comprehensive view of the magnitude of violence around the world, the factors that lead to violence, and, at the same time, the potential that exists to tackle this global public health problem. It provides data from around the world on suicide, child abuse, youth violence, sexual violence,abuse of the elderly, violence between intimate partners, and other areas of personal and social conflict.
3. The World Report on Violence and Health has three main goals. The first is to raise awareness of violence as a global public health problem. It is not simply an issue for the police and justice departments, for the military, or for international security councils.
4. Secondly, the report highlights the contributions of public health to understanding and preventing violence. The report's third goal is to increase the level of action taken by the public health community in response to prevent violence. The aim is a better balance between the health problems caused by violence and the resources invested in preventing it.
5.Deaths are only a very small part of the problem of violence. For each death caused by violence, there are many other people who suffer the social, psychological, and physical consequences of violence. Nevertheless, when deaths caused by violence are compared with deaths caused by other global public health problems, the importance of violence becomes alarmingly clear.
6. In 2000,There were over 1.6 million deaths due to violence. This is about half the number of deaths due to HIV/AIDS in that year, and about equal to the number of deaths due to tuberculosis. In 2000, violence took more lives than road traffic crashes and malaria.
7. At the broadest level, violence is divided into three major categories: self-directed,interpersonal, and collective. So we differentiate between violence a person inflicts upon himself or herself, violence inflicted by another individual or small group of individuals, and violence inflicted by larger groups or states.
8. When we speak of violence, it is important to understand these different categories. However, it is also crucial to understand that they are closely interrelated.Many risk factors are common to all forms of violence. These include alcohol, drugs, firearms, and economic and social inequalities. Reducing these risk factors will reduce all types of violence.
9. Facts and figures clearly demonstrate the enormous impact of violence on public health and health systems. But behind these figures are individuals and human tragedies.Violence of all types has a dramatic effect on the lives of the victims, the perpetrators and their families, often for a lifetime and sometimes for several generations.
10. To begin to tackle the problem of violence, we need to know its magnitude. Contrary to the impression given by the media, the largest number of violent deaths in 2000 was due not to war, but to suicide. 815,000 cases, or one suicide every 40 seconds. Interpersonal violence accounted for 520,000 deaths, or one murder per minute. There were 310,000 deaths directly due to collective violence. Part 2. Listen to the following short passages and then choose one of the answers that best fits the meaning of each passage. There are 10 questions in this part of the test. 2 points for each question.
One, winemakers such as Southcorp, Australia's biggest producer, have sharply raised output in the last 10 years as U.S. wine imports doubled in volume and almost tripled in value. France and Italy increased exports to the U.S. as consumption in their home markets contracted.
2. Now, with the U.S. currency down 26% against the Australian dollar, producers face the choice of trimming margins or raising prices in the face of a U.S. glut.
3. Peugeot Citroën, Europe's second biggest car maker, and Dongfeng Motor said that they would spend 600 million euros, or $761 million, to expand their Chinese venture.
4. The partners plan to introduce their first Peugeot model, based on the French automaker's 307 compact car, this quarter, and aim to double production capacity to 300,000 vehicles by the second half of 2006.
5. Aluminum Corp of China, the mainland's biggest maker of the metal, said that it would sell 3.1 billion Hong Kong dollars, or $40 million, of new shares to Alcoa and institutional investors to buy rivals and expand production amid record demand.
6. China's aluminum output may rise by a fourth this year, as economic growth of more than 8% fuels demand for power lines, car parts, and soda cans. Shares of Chalco rose more than fivefold last year, making the company the best performer on the 32-stock Hang Seng China Enterprise Index.
7. One-third of the proceeds from the Chalco sale will be used this year to buy smelters that process alumina into the finished metal. A third will be used to accelerate the refining of alumina from bauxite at the company's project in Shanxi. The remainder will be put toward working capital.
8. Chalco is China's only producer of alumina, which provides about half of its revenue. Alumina shortages in China, which relies on imports for about half of the 12 million tons of the material consumed in the country each year, may have cut domestic aluminum production by 700,000 tons in 2003.
9. The shortages of alumina are prompting competitions to try to enter Chalco's market or boost production overseas to supply China. The country's alumina imports rose 28% to 2.56 million tons in the first quarter of last year.
10. Chalco aims to boost aluminum capacity to 1.5 million metric tons a year by 2005, which would be 15% of the country's expected capacity by that time. That is below the company's 16% share in 2003. Part 3. Listen to the following longer passages and then choose the best answers to the questions. You may need to scribble a few notes in order to answer the questions satisfactorily. There are 4 passages in this part, each with 5 questions, and each question carries 2 points.
Passage 1. 100 years ago, Henry Ford set up in business and America's love affair with the automobile began. Ford is staging a party that would not have disgraced Jay Gatsby. And why not? The American car market has been roaring, with annual vehicle sales over 16 million. It could be close to 20 million in a decade's time, with another 26 million young Americans clamoring for their first set of wheels. Yet the ride is not going to be smooth. It will be more like cruising in a Ford Thunderbird while ignoring a nasty rumble from its mighty V8 engine. For all the signs are that things are going badly awry in Detroit. Unless something changes, the industry could go broke, with Ford, the most troubled of the big three car makers, leading the way. The 100th birthday party could swiftly be followed by a wake. This quintessential American industry has, admittedly, been written off before, only to bounce back. Chrysler entered the 1980s thanks to a federal bailout. Ford narrowly escaped bankruptcy around the same time. Washington also came to the industry's aid with restrictions on Japanese imports. Even so, Chrysler nearly came to grief again in the early 1990s, before it was sold to Daimler-Benz. In 1991, the combined losses of the big three topped $7 billion. General Motors, GM, was said to be within an hour of going bust in 1992, with its bosses staring at the fax machine as they waited for a credit rating downgrading that would have pushed the company over the edge. The downgrade never came, and GM recovered.
Passage 2. In the late 1920s, the American astronomer Edwin Hubble made a very interesting and important discovery. Hubble made observations that he interpreted as showing that distant stars and galaxies are receding from Earth in every direction. Moreover, the velocities of recession increase in proportion with distance, a discovery that has been confirmed by numerous and repeated measurements since Hubble's time. The implication of these findings is that the universe is expanding. Hubble's hypothesis of an expanding universe leads to certain deductions. One is that the universe was more condensed at a previous time. From this deduction came the suggestion that all the currently observed matter and energy in the universe were initially condensed in a very small and infinitely hot mass. A huge explosion, known as the Big Bang, then sent matter and energy expanding in all directions. This Big Bang hypothesis led to more testable deductions. One such deduction was that the temperature in deep space today should be several degrees above absolute zero. Observations showed this deduction to be correct. In fact, the Cosmic Microwave Background Explorer, COBE, satellite launched in 1991 confirmed that the background radiation field has exactly the spectrum predicted by a Big Bang origin for the universe.
Passage 3. In the early 1970s, evidence had accumulated showing that chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, were damaging the ozone layer in the stratosphere and increasing the amount of ultraviolet B, UVB radiation, reaching Earth's surface. Since the ozone layer protects humans, animals, and plants from the damaging effects of UVB radiation, the steady increase in CFCs and other ozone-depleting substances constituted a major potential health hazard. But it took a decade and a half of increasingly intensive effort to achieve an agreement that would resolve the problem. The 1987 Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer was a landmark international environmental agreement. It has been remarkably successful. Production of the most damaging ozone-depleting substances was eliminated, except for a few critical uses, by 1996 in developed countries, and should be phased out by 2010 in developing countries. Without the protocol, the levels of ozone-depleting substances would have been 5 times higher than they are today, and surface UVB radiation levels would have doubled at mid-latitudes in the northern hemisphere. On current estimates, the CFC's concentration in the ozone layer is expected to recover to pre-1980 levels by the year 2050. Prior to the protocol, intergovernmental negotiations on their own failed to mobilize sufficient support for the far-reaching measures that were needed. But intensive lobbying by civil society organizations, the presentation of overwhelming scientific evidence, and the discovery of the huge ozone hole over Antarctica eventually created the consensus necessary for the agreement to be signed.
Passage 4. Cities from the 18th century began a period of growth that has continued without break until today. In the larger cities, this process included large-scale suburbanization, which was made possible by the new railroad transportation systems for goods and passengers. Automobiles later enlarged the system to ever greater dimensions. Growth was both geographic and demographic. Cities grew because they served new functions for more people. One of these functions, which brought about much of the early growth, was the increasing importance of centralized government. The political and administrative function of many cities has continued and is evident not only in the great capitals of industrialized nations like Washington, Canberra, and Paris, but also in the capitals of nations that are not heavily industrialized, such as New Delhi, Beijing, Jakarta, Lagos, and Abidjan. Nevertheless, most economists believe that urbanization based primarily on government jobs is economically and socially problematic. Cities tend to grow on the basis of economic productivity. Indeed, much of the urban growth in the 19th century was a direct result of industrialization. The steam engine, which could be constructed anywhere, made the location of industries more flexible. Factories sprang up near port facilities, at inland transportation hubs, in the heart of raw materials resources centers like the Midlands of Britain or Silesia in Central Europe, and in large concentrations of consumers like the great cities of Paris and London. New industrial metropolises dotted the map.
Part 4. Write a summary of approximately 200 to 250 words of the passage you are going to hear. The passage is around 500 words in length. This part of the test carries 20 points.
The world is now in the 55th year without war among the major powers, the longest such period in the entire history of the modern system of states. In the area of Europe that now comprises the European Union, where most modern wars started, a security community has emerged, an association of states characterized by dependable expectations that disputes will be resolved by peaceful means. Moreover, nearly 5 decades of Cold War, sustained by a nuclear balance of terror that could have annihilated us all instantly, have passed. Some observers have lamented that fact, claiming that bipolarity was stable, predictable, and helped keep the peace. But that was hardly true in the developing world. There, the Cold War was a period of frequent armed conflict fueled by both sides in the bipolar world. Once the Cold War ended, that source of external political and material support ceased to exist. Freeing the United Nations from the shackles of the Cold War also enabled it to play a more significant role. The 1990s saw an upsurge both in our peacekeeping and in our peacemaking activities. 3 times more peace agreements were negotiated and signed during that decade than in the previous 3 combined. The frequency of interstate warfare has been declining for some time. Economic globalization has largely eliminated the benefits of territorial acquisition, while the destructiveness of modern warfare has increased its costs. The near doubling in the number of democracies since 1990 has been equally important because established democratic states, for a variety of reasons, rarely fight each other militarily. Wars since the 1990s have been mainly internal. They have been brutal, claiming more than 5 million lives. They have violated not so much borders as people. Humanitarian conventions have been routinely flouted, civilians and aid workers have become strategic targets, and children have been forced to become killers. Often driven by political ambition or greed, these wars have preyed on ethnic and religious differences. They are often sustained by external economic interests, and they are fed by a hyperactive and in large part illicit global arms market. In the wake of these conflicts, a new understanding of the concept of security is evolving. Once synonymous with the defense of territory from external attack, the requirements of security today have come to embrace the protection of communities and individuals from internal violence. The need for a more human-centered approach to security is reinforced by the continuing dangers that weapons of mass destruction, most notably nuclear weapons, pose to humanity. Their very name reveals their scope and their intended objective, if they were ever used. As we look ahead, we can see real risks that resource depletion, especially freshwater scarcities, as well as severe forms of environmental degradation, may increase social and political tensions in unpredictable but potentially dangerous ways. In short, these new security challenges require us to think creatively and to adapt our traditional approaches to better meet the needs of our new era. But one time-honored precept holds more firmly today than ever. It all begins with prevention.
Test 2. Comprehensive Examination for Interpreter 2. Part 1. Listen to the short passages and then decide whether the corresponding statements below are true or false. There are 10 questions in this part of the test. 2 points for each question.
1. Motorized road transport has changed the face of employment, trade, family life, and healthcare, bringing benefits that were unimaginable 100 years ago. We can now get patients to emergency rooms, deliver relief at the sites of disasters, and take holidays in places we would not have been able to visit before. However, the price we are paying for such benefits is too high. This is why we have chosen road safety as the theme for World Health Day 2004, and why we are launching the World Report on Road Traffic Injury Prevention.
2. During the course of any day, the tragic news of death on the road is delivered about 3,000 times to families and friends. 15,000 times, people will hear that one of their family members has survived a crash, but with serious injury and perhaps lifelong disability. The shock and grief these events cause are all too well known throughout the world. They are particularly well known in poorer countries, where 90% of the annual deaths occur.
3. In richer countries, the deaths and injuries are slowly decreasing, but in the poorer ones, they are still increasing rapidly. Victims and survivors are often young, leaving families to cope with the loss of a breadwinner. Most of these deaths, injuries, and economic losses can be prevented. In many high-income countries, an established set of interventions has contributed to significant reductions in the incidence and impact of road traffic injuries.
4. France is one such country. It has seen a 20% reduction in road traffic deaths since President Chirac made road safety one of his government's key priorities in 2002 and introduced a multi-sectoral approach to tackling the problem.
5. Not everyone is equally affected by the lack of road safety. In high-income countries, most victims and survivors are vehicle occupants. However, in low-income and middle-income countries in Asia, the vast majority are cyclists and motorcyclists. In Africa and South America, they are mostly pedestrians and users of public transportation.
6. A variety of approaches are being used to tackle some of the causes, including better legislation, enforcement, and information. A number of initiatives, from Colombia to Ghana, from Costa Rica to Vietnam, show that improving road safety is possible even in lower income settings.
7. Countries need to designate a lead agency in government which can coordinate the national road safety efforts. They also need to assess the problem, prepare a national road safety strategy, allocate financial and human resources, and implement specific interventions that are known to work. These include setting and enforcing laws on seatbelts, child restraints, helmets, and drunk driving, and promoting daytime running lights and improved visibility of all road users.
8. In addition to setting laws and raising awareness, countries need to formulate policies that promote safer vehicles, safer traffic management, and safer road design. The countries that have been most successful have been those that have engaged many different groups from government, civil society, and industry in a coordinated program of road safety.
9. Every sector is important. Transport, education, health, law enforcement, in tackling the problem. On this World Health Day, I call particularly upon the public health community to increase its contribution by strengthening emergency services for victims, improving data collection, contributing to policies, developing prevention activities, or simply ringing the alarm bell, as we are doing today, we can all make significant contributions.
10. Everyone can increase road safety in their private capacity as well, as drivers, passengers, and pedestrians, and as members of the public who influence decision makers. Road deaths and injuries are preventable. Let us use this World Health Day to draw attention to this fact. Part 2. Listen to the following short passages and then choose one of the answers that best fits the meaning of each passage. There are 10 questions in this part of the test. 2 points for each question.
1. The growing population has been moving steadily into cities. Mechanization of agriculture is one of the factors pushing people away from the countryside. In addition, jobs in manufacturing, bureaucracy, and service industries pull them to the cities.
2. At the beginning of the century, urbanization was still linked to industrial growth. By the end of the century, the most rapidly growing cities, and, increasingly, the largest of them, are in the poorer, less industrialized areas of the world. For example, Mexico City and São Paulo, each with about 20 million in 1990, Bombay and Calcutta in India, and Buenos Aires, Argentina, each with about 11.5 million.
3. In many of the richer countries, however, in a process termed counter-urbanization, cities have turned inside out, and central city populations are actually declining. Poorer citizens remain in the center as the richer avail themselves of the new means of transportation and of communication via phone, fax, and the World Wide Web to relocate to the suburbs.
4. Businesses, too, recognizing a new freedom of movement, are leaving the central cities, partly to reduce their overhead costs. Multinational corporations cross international boundaries to relocate their factories, removing them from high-wage urban centers in the first world to new sites offering cheaper labor in the third.
5. Since the building of the first aircraft in 1930 by Wilbur and Orville Wright, and the first solo flight across the Atlantic in 1927 by Charles Lindbergh, international and intercontinental travel has become commonplace. Flights are taken for business and pleasure, and tourism has become one of the world's largest industries. In 1989, 38 million people visited the USA, spending $43 billion. Students, in particular, travel around the globe for formal and informal study and work opportunities.
6. 20th century technology has transformed the quality of daily life as well as its location and density. The automobile, bus, truck, train, airplane, and jet affect transportation for almost all citizens of the world. The revolution in the means of communication, telegraph, telephone, copier, fax machine, modem, internet, radio phonograph, various kinds of sound reproduction, photography, motion pictures, television, satellite transmission, and cable have opened visions of the whole world to potentially all its citizens.
7. They have totally transformed work and play as well as the distribution of these activities in geographical space. Air conditioning has not only changed standards of comfort, but has opened many warmer areas of the world, including the southern United States, to increased immigration and development.
8. The computer has not only affected transportation and communication, but also has transformed data processing, office work, and the further development of both large-scale organizations and of science. With the advent of the World Wide Web, it is now quite conceivable that future generations may never have to leave their homes to work, shop, bank, and to communicate with friends and family.
9. New technology systems, such as the automated assembly line production of Henry Ford's automobile factories, the more recent introduction of robotics, and the management techniques of Frederick Taylor have changed the way we work and the efficiency of our production. Scientific research facilities have been established by private corporations like the Rockefeller Foundations, and most of all, by national governments all over the world. They have changed our concept and mode of creativity. No longer needing to rely on experienced, gifted artisans tinkering in small shops, 20th century technology has systematized invention and promoted an increasing demand for ever more sophisticated and more expensive research facilities.
10. Synthetic fabrics and dyes have changed our wardrobes. Plastics have been the most important new man-made material of the 20th century and have replaced metals, rubber, and glass in innumerable uses. They have also increased the world's reliance on petroleum, a non-renewable fossil fuel from which plastics are synthesized.